Court calls United States v. Woods. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Gabriel Bradley, and along with Lieutenant David Werning, I represent the appellant. Chief Judge Baker, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
The member questionnaire asked Captain Villalobos an open-ended question. What is your opinion of the military justice system? It's a wide open question. Her answer could have been anything. And out of the whole universe of possible answers, the first thing that comes to her mind is guilty until proven innocent. First thing she wrote. But she didn't stop there. She went on to defend her views, arguing, giving reasons for why guilty until proven innocent is, in her words, essential. This shows that Captain Villalobos was not simply mistaken about the law. Not only did she believe that guilty until proven innocent is what the law is, she believed it's what the law should be. And the test for actual bias is whether she could set this view aside and apply a different standard. And not a standard that's just a little bit different, but the exact opposite standard. So in his preliminary instructions, the military judge told her what the correct standard is. And in voir dire, the trial counsel asked her leading questions to reinforce and remind her about what the correct standard is.
Is it your view that a member who says such a thing cannot be rehabilitated, or that the manner in which the member was rehabilitated in this case was inadequate?
You know, I would say that it would be very difficult to rehabilitate a member who comes into it with the view, a sincerely held view, that guilty until proven innocent is an essential standard in the military. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying it was not done in this case, and it would be very difficult to do.
And why would that be different than rehabilitating a member who said, I've read a newspaper article about the case? Is there something qualitatively different about what was on the questionnaire here from other implied bias cases?
Well, I read a newspaper article about the case. It's not by itself a grounds for challenge. That by itself, you need to develop it more to find out, you know, whether that actually rose to the level of bias. Here, when she comes from the standard, from the perspective of guilty until proven innocent, then that does by itself meet one of the definitions, one of the grounds for challenge, which is that it affects the fairness of the proceedings. So right there, what you need to do is just get more facts on the record to sort of flesh this out and illuminate and find out how deeply held is this belief, how long has she held this belief, those sorts of things.
Does the record reflect whether this questionnaire was presented to the convening authority as part of the Article 25 selection process? And if so, does the record reflect whether the convening authority actually reviewed it as opposed to constructively reviewed it?
You know, there's not a part of the record that says the convening authority put his eyeballs on this, but she did fill it out and sign it before the convening order was issued, about a month and a half before the convening order was issued. So you can make an inference there that this was part of the process of panel selection in this case.
And the inference is drawn exclusively from the chronology?
Yes, Your Honor. And so after she's been instructed on what the right standard is and reminded of it on voir dire, she still says it's up to the parties to present a case. So even though she's just been instructed that's not true, she still has this expectation that it's up to the accused to try to prove his innocence. So that shows that this bias, this perspective that she came in with, did not yield to the military judge's instructions. She was still hanging on to it even though she'd just been instructed that's not the case. And so then after that, the military judge tries to rehabilitate her with a series of leading questions and doesn't ask her a single open-ended question. And so again, there's nothing to flesh out sort of how long she's held this belief, how strongly she has. The only glimpse we have of that is this: she talks about having had a conversation with her husband. We don't know how long ago that was, whether she had the idea before the conversation or if it's just something she talked about. We don't know who brought it up in conversation. We don't know anything about this to sort of clue us in into whether this was, how strongly held this was, but we do know that when she had just been instructed on what the correct standard is, she still reverts back to this expectation that it's up to the accused to put on evidence of his innocence.
Counsel, I'd like to explore a little bit more what the Chief Judge just raised. Who developed this questionnaire?
That's not something that I believe the record goes into in terms of who developed the questionnaire. I can speak to usual practice is that the Commuting Authorities SJA usually circulates questionnaires to solicit potential panel members. The questionnaire itself does indicate that it's the Judicial Circuit's questionnaire, so that would suggest it's something that's standard to use throughout that region.
And what's the purpose of the questionnaire?
Well, this is not from the record, but speaking to what the traditional practice is the Committee Authorities SJA uses the questionnaire to gather more information about potential members and make recommendations to the Committee Authority, which the Committee Authority is usually informed that he's free to either accept the recommendations or completely disregard them, applying his own discretion.
Can we infer that somebody in that selection process reviewed the questionnaire? Or
I think that is a very fair inference, Your Honor. Otherwise, why have it? Otherwise, why attach it as an appellate exhibit? I think it's very safe to infer that this questionnaire played a part in the panel selection, which is a factor that would go into the implied bias analysis of the hypothetical member of the public of knowing all the facts and circumstances and being familiar with the military justice system. Presumably, they'd be familiar with the chronology as well, that these statements were made before she was even selected. And this is something that the Committee Authority would have been able to have access to, with these knowing that these statements were made.
What are we to take from the fact that after the military judge gave his general instructions to the potential panel on burden of proof and everything, which were 180 off from what she said in her questionnaire, the military judge asked, okay, now I've given these instructions, does anybody have any questions? And she didn't have any questions. Does that mean that we can assume that, okay, she found out, I was wrong and this is right, or that those instructions had no impact on her? I mean, or could it go either way?
I think it could go either way, Your Honor. Okay. Just the mere silence itself doesn't tell us a whole lot. I would even go so far as to say she was probably trying her best to apply the instructions. But even though she just got the instruction, and then was specifically reminded by the trial counsel, he didn't just let that instruction sit. He asked her to turn to her member's questionnaire to read question 20, and after having just refreshed her, then he brought it into direct contradistinction to the military judge's instructions and made sure that she understood that what she had written was incorrect and was 180 degrees away from the correct standard. So she had just been reminded of that. And a few minutes later, she says this thing about it's up to the parties, it's up to them to present a case so that we can determine whether he's guilty or not.
And so, is it your position that had the military judge or the trial counsel actually delved into what her beliefs were and got her to answer in a more narrative fashion than responding to leading questions, that she could have been rehabilitated?
Yes, Your Honor. It's possible, depending on what she said. Exactly. They could have developed facts that could have made it, that could have, A, showed that she was willing to set these beliefs aside and apply the correct standard, or B, that would have reassured a member of the public that there was no concern about the appearance of fairness here. So that could have happened had there been more of a record developed. It didn't happen, but certainly opening the questions like, again, how long have you held this belief? Do you have any sense of where it came from, these conversations with your husband? How many? Was one conversation? Was a lot of conversations? Did you bring it up? Did he bring it up? Just sort of get an idea of how deep down in her this belief is. That could have revealed facts that would have dissipated the concern about her bias.
Does it matter that the mistaken belief was on a matter of law as opposed to prejudice against a particular group of which the accused is a member or some other bias that's more an area of fact? Do we expect members coming in the door cold to know the law?
No, Your Honor, we don't. And if this were a simple matter of she thought the law was A, but it was actually B, then maybe no harm, no foul there. But she didn't just think that this is what the law was. She thought this is the way the law should be. And she had reasons and arguments for why the law should be this way. And it's not just any mistake about the law. This isn't, for example, people have mistakes with law all the time. I mean, you can't convict on circumstantial evidence. You can't listen to hearsay. You have to be read your rights every time the cops talk. People have mistakes about the law. But this is about fundamental fairness. These are the two fundamental pillars of due process, presumption of innocence and the government's burden of proof. And those are undermined by her statements here. So it's not a trivial matter. If she had come in and said, well, I mean, even from this case, later on in her voir dire, when they're talking about can you consider the full range of punishments, you know, they say, can you consider a punishment of no punishment whatsoever? And she said, oh, well, now that I know that that's one of the options, yes, I can consider it. So that's a relatively trivial matter. Now that you've been informed this is an option, will you consider it? Yes, I will.
And the military judge found or seemed to find that she didn't have a mistaken view of the legal presumption, that she just thought that military personnel should exhibit good manners and, wear clean underwear and polish their shoes and otherwise set a nice example. Is that the kind of finding we can even review?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or is that just a question of fact?
Yes, it is a finding you can review. It is a question of fact. So you review it under a clearly erroneous standard. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense in context.
Well, she said that we give up our civil rights.
Exactly. That's why the military judge's finding, it doesn't make any sense and is clearly erroneous. It's not supported by the record. Her scenario about a petty officer going out in town and behaving himself and not getting drunk, that has nothing to do with the context in which that question was asked. That open-ended, what is your opinion about the military justice system? So because her answer, it's clearly not what she meant when she said higher standard. When you look in context, her statement, she used that term higher standard, that's not what she meant. And it was clearly erroneous for the military judge to find otherwise. And that shows that he abused his discretion. He was, instead of applying the liberal grant mandate and saying, we're gonna get her off the panel, he strains to conclude that she's saying something else than what she's saying, something that doesn't make any sense. And so that was an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, the briefs in this case were written before this court issued Peters and Castillo a week or so ago. Do the holdings in either of those cases alter your argument or have any impact on this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Peters, in particular, has an impact on the standard review for the implied bias issue, because in Peters, the military judge, he at least recited what the test was for implied bias. And the military judge here didn't even do that. So in Peters, the court decided to give less deference to the military judge. And that was a closer case than this one. So Peters underscores the appellant's argument that this court should give, if it reaches the implied bias issue, should give no deference to the military judge's ruling. All he did was say the words implied bias. He did not recite the test on the record, and he did not make any findings that would be relevant, and he certainly didn't do the legal analysis on the record. So there's no reason to give deference to his ruling on the implied bias.
Now, you say if this court reaches the issue of implied bias, are you saying that we have to first address actual bias before we go to implied bias?
You know, I'm not saying you have to reach one before the other. In Nash, this court looked at actual bias and then didn't reach implied bias because of that.
What do you think is your strongest argument? Actual bias or implied bias?
Actual bias, Your Honor. This does not just look bad. This is bad. This is not an appearances problem. This is a substantive fairness problem. She came into it with this idea that the accused has an obligation to prove his innocence. And the government points to the fact that, well, she asked questions later on during the exam. That's beside the point. If you start from the position of expecting the accused to prove his innocence, if that's the way that you're going to evaluate the evidence that's presented, then it doesn't matter how many questions you ask or how good you're doing a job of paying attention.
But the problem there is that we give, in actual bias analysis, we give the military judge a great deal of discretion because he's there viewing the witnesses and evaluating the testimony. And this military judge went to great lengths to explain why he was doing it.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And, I mean, we could certainly say, well, if I was there, I may not have done that. But in the broad discretion that we give them, how can you prevail?
Because, Your Honor, the findings that he made were about her demeanor. And that was almost exclusively what they're about. And by focusing on her demeanor, he was focusing on the surface and ignoring the substance of what she was saying. And keep in mind, too, she may have had good demeanor when she was answering a series of leading questions. So when she was told the answer and said, do you agree with that? And she said, yes, right, I do. Okay, so she was calm and presumably judicial sounding when she said, yes, I do, yes, I do, yes, I do.
So are you suggesting that she's lying?
I'm not suggesting that she's lying, Your Honor, but I'm suggesting that her demeanor in the courtroom when she's answering leading questions is of little value and there's not much else than that that you can defer to. So when you're applying abuse of discretion, it's does her demeanor in the courtroom, which, you know, there's that finding that she had a judicious demeanor in the courtroom, and what that means when you're saying yes, 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 I'm not sure, but you have to balance that, whatever value that is, against the substance of what she is saying.
Didn't he say at one point that he found her credible?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying she wasn't doing her best. I'm not saying she was lying or disingenuous or anything. I'm sure she was doing her best. But as this court pointed out in Nash, there are some contexts in which the member's own assertion of whether or not they can be fair and impartial is not really what you're going to rely on.
And this is that case? No matter what she would have said, she should have...
Because it's so fundamental, Your Honor. Yes. And because even after she had just been instructed, she still gets it wrong. When she's asked open-ended questions, when she's given free rein, she gets it wrong. She got it wrong in the first open-ended question she was asked, and in the very limited open-ended questioning she got from trial defense counsel, she again comes back to it's up to them to present a case. So every bit of free rein she gets it wrong. And that is, when you look at the substance of that, it doesn't matter the demeanor, no matter, and it doesn't matter that she was credible, she was trying her best. In this case, with this issue being so fundamental, her best was not good enough, and especially in light of the liberal grant mandate, it was an abuse of discretion for the military judge for being her on the panel. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, Your Honors. My name is Lieutenant Ann Dingle, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the challenge to Captain Villalobos, as she had no actual bias. No, moreover, this is not the type of extreme and rare situation in which implied bias could exist. Turning first to actual bias, this is bias that will not yield to the military judge's instructions and evidence at trial. Here, we have, with a careful review of Captain Villalobos' member's questionnaire and her voir dire, it's clear that this is a member who had almost no experience with any sort of legal proceedings. She was a dentist, a dental corps officer. She had no prior court-martial experience, no NJPs, Article 15s, no summary court-martials, no ATSEP boards. She had never even followed any civilian criminal trials.
Which does make us wonder what the Article 25 criteria for experience means, does it not?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but...
Wasn't the convening authority supposed to apply Article 25 to this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he seems to, in your views, not mine, but your words, have selected the least qualified and experienced person he could have found at Pearl Harbor.
Your Honor, it's not clear that the experience that commanders are looking for necessarily means legal experience, but rather experience in the military and life experience in general. Here,
Let me ask you this. What does the record reflect, if anything, as to whether the questionnaire was presented to the convening authority at the time of member selection?
Your Honor, I'm...
You heard the appellant, you know, the appellant's version of his answer to that, so the question is what's your answer to that?
The record does not reflect that I'm aware, although obviously
it's not a trick question. I couldn't tell myself, but like that's why I'm asking.
Well, normally would that be reviewed by in the selection process?
Yes.
The questionnaire?
Yes.
So we can infer that somebody along the line, the SJAA perhaps, read this and said, we need an 06.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are questionnaires not, are they usually presented to the convening authority?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so is it fair to say that in the government's view, the question of fact here is not whether it went to the convening authority, but whether it was read by the convening authority? In fact, read?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
Is it fair to infer in the government's view that the questionnaire was presented to the convening authority, but we don't know whether the convening authority actually read it? Is that a fair inference?
Your Honor, I think it's fair to infer that the convening authority followed proper procedure and actually...
And actually read the questionnaire?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then we would infer that this was a member who was selected based on that questionnaire?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
However, members arriving at a court-martial are not expected to know the law, and this is, in fact, why we have military judges' instructions at the beginning of trial, even before voir dire begins. Now, here we have Captain Villalobos, now heard during her voir dire, and I think appellant misrepresents a bit the nature of the questions that she was presented with. In fact, trial defense counsel asked her a number of extremely open-ended questions resulting in narrative answers where she was extremely forthright and stated, yes, I had an incorrect understanding of the law. I've heard what the law is, and I understand it now, and I can follow those instructions.
Well, okay, here's the joint appendix. At 80, she's being voir dired by defense counsel. Do you hold him to a higher standard because we're in a military court than you would in a civilian court? Well, I think we should be held to a higher standard as when we put the uniform on and as we behave and as we go about our business, we should be held to a higher standard. Defense counsel, okay. Once you're in a court of law is, you know, then it's up to the parties to them to find him, to present a case so that we were presented with the facts and see if he's guilty or not. ADC, should we hold him to a higher standard? Would you give aid on the side of the government because he's in the uniform, we should hold him to a higher standard? Captain Villalobos. Well, it's hard for me to say if I'm in that position. I think it depends on the facts that are presented. Like, you know, if that, I mean the facts are, and if they have a case presented to in a way that, yes, they prove he's guilty, that he's guilty, you know. I mean, I don't know if, I'm not sure what you're asking me. Here's not a junior member, but the 06 president of the court, responding to voir dire in this fashion, and then magically, when the military judge asks her a series of leading questions, it's yes sir, three bags full, I can follow instructions, I was totally wrong, and that's it, sir. Thank you. Does that make sense as a matter of human psychology, if anything else?
Your Honor,
that she could just divest herself of this confused melange of impressions she has, and we're supposed to ignore all that and simply go with, well, can you follow my instructions? Yes, sir. Do you believe what I tell you now? Yes, sir. Okay, good enough. You can sit.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the best example of her really rehabilitating herself is, I believe it's later on in that colloquy with defense counsel, where she gives an example of what she is talking about, higher standards. If I see Petty Officer Schmacatelli out in town, and I see Mr. Schmacatelli out in town, I expect him to, Petty Officer, to not get drunk and act
right,
like this and that. It's clear that when she's saying higher standards, she means a higher moral standard, a higher...
Didn't she say in voir dire that we give up our civil rights?
She stated that in her member's
questionnaire. In her member's questionnaire.
Yes, sir.
That we give up our civil rights. That's something different, isn't it, from adhering to a higher moral standard?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. However, in voir dire, she also says...
I mean, she may have held both. You know, they're not mutually exclusive. We give up our civil rights, and we're also held to a higher moral standard. Those aren't mutually exclusive.
No, they're not, Your Honor.
So where does that leave us?
Well, Your Honor, I think in her voir dire, she says, I understand now that we don't give up our civil rights, or we wouldn't be here today. So here we have someone, and this, I think, is the best comparison case that we can look at is Napolitano, where we have a member who comes in with certain preconceptions and supposed biases, but the court still finds that there, most people in that position would not consider themselves bound by their initial comments suggesting bias. The member was fully rehabilitated and was credible in saying, no, I can follow the instructions. I understand what you're telling me. I understand what I have to do.
In looking at that colloquy with the defense counsel, the defense counsel says, I guess my question is, do you hold him to a higher standard because we're in the military court than you would if we were in a civilian court? And she said, well, so do I think we should be held to a higher standard? I do think we should be held to a higher standard as when we put the uniform on. So it seems to me that she is implying there's a higher standard because they're in a military court rather than in a civilian court. And I think that goes back to some of the general confusion that her responses illustrate. And it's difficult to see how that is an effective rehabilitation from a statement that is 180 off the basic presumption in the American criminal justice system.
Your Honor, Captain Villalobos is not an attorney, and I think that part of the problem is that the questions that we're asking, we're using legal terminology, and she's using a more colloquial understanding of the word standard. She thinks of standards as making sure that you behave.
Oh, no, she knew enough. She knew what the standard was in the civilian sector, and she knew in her own mind that the standard was the opposite in the military sector. So at least she knew that much. She was wrong, but she had some familiarity with it.
But in her questionnaire, she didn't call that standard, Your Honor. So when she's speaking about standards, she's talking about behavior, moral behavior, and not standard burdens of proof.
Guilty until proven innocent is a moral standard?
No, Your Honor. When she says standard during her voir dire, she's talking about holding military members to a higher moral standard. But when she says guilty until proven innocent, she doesn't use the word standard.
This is the basis of rehabilitation? It's a pretty narrow basis. Is it not sort of a legalistic interpretation of whether she's talking about standards or morals or something like that?
No, Your Honor. It's just one aspect of her overall rehabilitation.
And the rest comes in the form of the responses to the military judge?
And appellate defense counsel and trial counsel for approximately 16 pages of voir dire.
Speaking of standards, what's the standard that this court should apply in reviewing the judge's decision?
For actual bias, Your Honor?
And then applied.
Your Honor, I think just to discuss a little bit about the government's brief with regard to the standard for implied bias. Now, in the past, this court, I understand, has applied the less than abuse of discretion, but more than de novo standard of review. Looking to federal courts, most federal courts apply a de novo review, but it's implied, basically, quoting from the Ninth Circuit, implied bias is reviewed de novo, but because it is a mixed question of law and fact, it is not entirely a blank slate. So, or from a logical, mathematical sort of analysis, abuse of discretion is a factual component and a legal component. Once you determine that there is no actual bias, disregard the factual findings of the military judge as to demeanor, credibility, and whether or not this person actually was biased, and look instead to the legal question of whether, depending on, again, the test you use, whether the public would perceive a person, this person sitting on the panel, to be, cause a poor perception of this trial, or whether or not most people in that situation would be biased.
So in your brief, you were not arguing in implied bias that this court should impose a de novo standard of review?
No, Your Honor. The government, in the interest of simplifying the analysis for the courts of criminal appeals, the government is advocating that this court apply a de novo review with factual underpinning.
Isn't that less favorable to the government?
It is, Your Honor, in one respect. However,
I noticed the appellant jumped right on and agreed with that.
So. Yes, Your Honor.
So we shouldn't take into account during implied bias military judge's assessment of the facts or credibility and that sort of thing?
No, certainly not of...
We should jump in and push the military judge aside and provide our own credibility judgment.
Well, because implied bias doesn't have any... the test for implied bias doesn't take into account the credibility of the member.
So the member of the public doesn't take into account all the facts and circumstances, including the voir dire with the military judge and the military judge's judgment as to the credibility of the witness?
Okay, so a public perception test, perhaps. I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question?
Well, I'm just trying to get at what I'm just exploring why the government would want to not take into account, but just as a matter of observing what occurs, the demeanor and credibility judgments of the member that the military judge extrapolates. And if we're doing de novo, we'll just forget that.
I think I understand where you're getting at, Your Honor. The findings, again, of the military judge are not relevant to that analysis because implied bias is a legal finding of bias regardless of whether or not actual bias existed.
Yeah, but I mean, the way that it currently works, though, is it's the member of the public that knows all the facts and circumstances, including what the military judge thinks about what the people have said and what the person said. I mean, why would you want to throw that out? Why doesn't that matter?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I think we understand your position,
yeah, you
and we're free to agree or disagree with it.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
So, jumping to implied bias, we have this fictional construct that probably doesn't exist in nature, who is the reasonable man who has no experience with the armed forces, but who knows all about the system. What do you think the reasonable man who's never been in the armed forces but knows all about the system would think of this person sitting?
So you're asking what the public perception...
Yeah, what's public perception of this person after getting through this voir dire and being led by the judge? What would the public think of that?
I think a reasonable member of the public looking at all of her answers throughout voir dire, both to the military judge, trial counsel, and defense counsel, would understand that most military members and most jury members in civilian courts don't know what the law is before they come into court.
But what would the public think of the fact that this member of the public knows about the military justice system? Think of the fact that the convening authority, presumably reading the questionnaire, out of all the people, all the O6s in the command, says, this is the person I'm going to put on this court martial.
Your Honor, I think that I don't know if I am equipped to address that because my understanding
is that... Well, aren't we required
to
address that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Aren't we required to address that?
That would be an issue of member selection, Your Honor, which is not before this court. This is an issue...
So you're drawing a line in terms of implied bias, saying that we're only focusing on what happened in that courtroom.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we can't consider the fact, in your view, of what the actions of the convening authority was in terms of determining who the members would be?
No, Your Honor, that's not, I don't, that's not before this court at this point. I mean, to follow up on that, examining Captain Villalobos' answers, examining her extreme forthrightness in explaining that she was incorrect, she had a misapprehension of the law, and you know, going to the actual bias question, the military judge found that she had a very judicial temperament and, quote, seemed unsurprised that she was, in fact, incorrect in her previous understanding of the law. So here, this is not a person, and I think as the military judge put it best, if the members' questionnaire was a civics quiz, we might be in a different situation, but that's not the case. There are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have the opportunity for rebuttal.
Counsel, what's your position on the government's position about the fact that it's not before this court about whether we can consider, from the implied bias perspective, the process used by the convening authority?
The test is that the reasonable member of the public considers all the relevant facts and circumstances to determine whether the panel that tried the accused was composed of fair and impartial members. So everything that goes into how that panel gets selected is fair game. That's considered
Didn't you tell us before that if there's nothing in the record about how this panel was selected?
There's very little other than inferences from the chronology, Your Honor, yes. And so government counsel...
I just want to be fair, right? Which is we don't know.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And government counsel is right. Improper selection, failure to apply Article 25, that's a separate grounds for appeal, and that's not before the court. But that's not to say that the facts, what little facts there are on the record, are completely irrelevant and should be ignored.
Isn't one of the historical basis of the implied bias challenge a weapon against unlawful command influence?
Absolutely right, Your Honor. The policy behind implied bias is implicated by the selection. And the government conceded that it's a fair inference from this record that the convening authority actually read the responses before issuing the convening order. So given that, I would say yes, it's something to be considered in the totality of the facts and circumstances. And again, the link between the higher moral standard and the burden of proof is in the questionnaire itself. She said that this standard is essential because we are held to a higher standard. So no, they're not mutually exclusive. They're linked in her mind, this higher moral standard, and the reason why it's essential we have guilty until proven innocent. So that's why the military judge abused his discretion by ignoring it. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. Case is submitted. Until further order, we'll stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you.
All right.
Something like that.